CW News Time, 7:42. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, next week, Park City Municipal will be holding a meeting to update residents about the new Old Town Parking Management Plan. In the studio with details, I have parking consultant Julie Dixon, along with parking manager Kenzie Colson and transportation director Alfred Knott. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Kenzie, maybe you can just give us the details when and where that meeting's going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're looking for another community forum to be held at the Miners Hospital Wednesday the 31st at 5 p.m., and all are welcome. We've had really great turnout at our recent meetings, and this is a continuation of that. You can expect us to hold more in the future as well. And I really want to thank the community for coming out to our recent meetings, because what we've heard from the people has shaped the staff report that is going to council today. And I really appreciate that, and that's what we want out of these meetings, is to hear what people are worried about and then respond.
Okay, so can you tell me a few of the changes you think you've made in that plan based on community recommendations?
The substantial concern and comment has been regarding making sure that we have adequate transportation solutions and incentives in place to coincide with the demand-based paid parking. And, of course, this has always been an initiative, but with so many folks worried about the timing of how all these transportation updates are lining up, our report today is designed to give an update on where we're at with all of our incentives and our programs, and Alfred can speak to a little bit where we're at with our transportation goals. But within that, we're going to have a discussion about the paid parking launch and recommend that we launch December 15th, nightly paid parking at 5 p.m. And so this is really coming from the people, and it will give time to ensure that all of our incentives are well in place and well established.
All right. So, Julie, how much information will you have? I mean, details till now really have been pretty sketchy in terms of what this means, how much it's going to cost.
Sure. So we're we're actually working on that right now. Currently, the vendor that's actually going to be doing the garage makeover is here, and we're actually doing all of the design work for the installation of all of the equipment and all of the infrastructure. What's really going to be a big impact is what we've talked about before, is the garage makeover. The garage needs a deep cleaning before we can do really much of anything, including applying the paint. And so that's really kind of what the focus has been, as we've talked about in the past, is really getting that hardware and technology engaged. And also, we get to start to collect data as soon as we have that equipment installed as well, is that we really can see when the garage is being utilized, when people are parking, at what times. We've outlined some rate models, and the intent is to go to council potentially next month and actually propose the different rate structures, and also hopefully have a plan for long term of what that means for permit holders as well.
Okay, so you don't have that information for me if I was working on Main Street, how much it's going to cost me each night to park?
Not yet. And so the intent, though, is that there won't be any changes to that plan until, again, the whole rollout for the incentive programs along with the TDM later on this, basically in early winter.
Okay, so to get the garage ready, that means that all of us who park in there now, where are we going to park while that cleaning is being done?
So what will happen is that the garage, actually, the plan will happen incrementally. So they'll take the garage in sections. So there'll be signage and instructions. So you'll park in different parts of the garage or maybe different levels of the garage while that work is basically taking place.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, so once we find out how much it's going to cost, and again, I'm talking about the Main Street employee who works maybe 4 to midnight, who parks in here now with the parking permit or whatever, I'm assuming that they're not going to be able to afford to pay that or not want to pay that much to park. So where are we going to put them, and how are they going to get to work?
We did just procure the yard a few months ago, and we have gone to council about how to best use that parcel in the interim. And so we've looked at having that parcel online for maybe 1 to 2 years, where we could have employees park there and then have a shuttle directly to Main Street also. And then also we're working with the county and UDOT to construct the park and ride lot out of Ecker also. And then we're also implementing express service from the Kimball Junction area also, which will have 10-minute headways to get people into town and get to work on time. And then also we're working on our e-bike program, and then also as well the Downtowner program, which will be an app-based service where we can have demand response transit also within the city limits of Park City. So going back to what Kenzie said, is we're trying to build all these programs and have them all in place in advance of having the paid parking, so people can adjust their schedules, know what the systems are, know what those hours of operation are with the yard, with the new express bus service, And how to best access their employment centers.
All right. So the word, I guess, really this morning is that this is not being implemented until just right before the busy holiday season, December 15th. Is that just because of the challenges that you're up against and things have been delayed, or is it just because that's when it makes sense to do it?
You know what? It's really when it makes sense to do it. We've talked about the transparency of this process all along the way, and it's really about making sure that everyone's informed and aware. And to be sure that the right public outreach is happening, I know that we've got folks that are going to be going door to door to the restaurants and actually reaching out to the service workers to make sure that they're participating in these public forums as well. And just making sure, again, that the word gets out. Education is really key. We want parking to be easy. We want transportation to be easy. And we want to make sure that this is a sustainable program. This is not something that happens overnight. We want to do it the right way. And we want to make sure it's really effective for Park City.
So for the Main Street employee, and I'm going to include the KPCW staff in there as well since we use the garage, what does that mean then for the daytime worker? Because this is only going to be a nighttime paid parking program?
Initially, that's the plan. I won't say that that will necessarily be for the future long term, but the initial intent is it's for the nighttime parking. And that's where the real impact is in downtown. And so, but the data is key. I have to highlight again is that once we really start to see utilization and usage, we've talked before about the skiers that park and take the shuttle, you know, up the mountain and things like that. We really got to see what usage is and base decisions on data and actually on fact rather than speculation. Parking is a lot about perception. We've talked about that before. We want to make sure we have the facts so we can make decisions when it really comes out and the outcome.
All right. So, for those daytime uses of China Bridge, then new parking permits will be sold again as of January 1?
Those details are still being determined. And what tonight's meeting at council will do is launch us into a discussion about this idea and this recommendation from staff and experts. But that will put us in a spot where we can look deeper at the ecosystem, so to speak, because permits have to relate to the timing and the structure of all of what we're doing on street and off street. And so not to go into this too deeply, but we do have a lot of draft information, but tonight will put us in a spot where we really can delve into the details.
Okay, I have just a minute left. Alfred, yeah. I wanted to ask you about last Friday's decision by the State Transportation Commission authorizing $10 million to begin the high occupancy vehicle lanes on 248.
Yes, we're very excited about that. We've been able to advance that project. We'll be coming to council in the next few weeks to actually award our engineering and preliminary engineering and environmental contract with Lochner to move that project forward. The ability for the city to fund the first portion of this project really put the initiative forward with the state also to advance the project too. So they see that our local dollars are leveraging their state and federal dollars also. So it's a very exciting time. We'll get a lot of field work done over the season, doing the environmental surveys, the design surveys, the drainage analysis, and all that fun stuff that comes along with doing a project of this significance.
All right. So give us an idea. I mean, I know the engineering hasn't been done, but there's not enough room for four lanes, or is there?
That's what we're going to reevaluate. We're not going to go back and reinvent the wheel here because there's been a lot of work leading up to that, but they do need to lay out what the right-of-way impacts are, potentially what we might need to acquire. There is a 100-foot right-of-way swath through that whole corridor, so there might be require some limited improvements along there. But there is the ability to fit the four lanes in there. But we also want to make sure that we're not doing anything to kind of compromise the environment and the scenic quality as well. And kind of going back to all those programs you mentioned as well, and parking, all of these things do not work unless we have some type of paid parking demand. You know, we're going to put a lot of investment in the services I mentioned with the expanded transit service, e-bike programs, and all of our commuter services that we're working on, too, from Camas and expanding the PCSLC Connect. Unless we have some type of demand that's going to adjust behaviors and being able to kind of shift people's modes and thoughts, you know, all these investments are going to be for naught. So I just want to make sure that we kind of plug back that what the whole system is and that the overall system needs to work based on all of these elements.
Okay, need to leave it there. Alfred, Kenzie, Julie, thanks for your time this morning. Well, the Summit County Council, of course, meeting yesterday with the Knob Hill home, just one of the items on the agenda. On the phone with me with a recap of the meeting, County Council Member Chris Robinson. Good morning, Chris.
How are you, Leslie?
Doing well, thank you. On the Knob Hill house, the council, as we reported, put off the decision. What do you need to further study, or are there some areas where you do need some more information?
Well, I think that we received some information at the 11th hour by Bruce Baird that it wasn't fair to our staff, who, of course, have granted the low-impact permit, or to the other side, Joe Rona's client, to review it. And so we want them to take a few weeks. We gave them until the 19th of June to brief us on their best and final arguments as to why they think we should act in one way or the other. And we're going to just see what they come up with, and then we'll either hold another hearing or we'll make a decision. Likely hold another hearing to announce our decision at least.
So the council talked a lot about the Snyderville Basin code language. The question is, does the code flatly prohibit building on the ridge lines, or does it prohibit just as much scarring on the hillside by a road and driveway?
Well, both of these provisions, you know, we want to avoid ridge lines and excessive scarring, but I think the kind of the underlying rule of law issue is that we want to avoid a taking. So what happens is, and there's kind of an echo in here, I don't know if you're hearing it, but what happens is if you have a lot that was legally created, and let's say that it's all a ridgeline, or that it's all over 30% slope, or it would require more than 20,000 square feet of disturbance to build on, then we can't categorically say, no, you can't build on that. So in our code, we have a provision that says you can't build on the ridgeline. Certain ridgelines in the Snyderville Basin is viewed from certain highways and public streets. And in this case, and that's the general rule. And if there isn't another place on which, if there isn't a place on the lot that doesn't violate that rule, then we have to, you know, we mitigate for it, but we would allow it. And so in this case, it's really, we want the attorneys to come back and to give us their opinions on our code as to, you know, which is more sacrosanct, limiting disturbance or the ridgeline. I have some opinions on it, but I'm not, you know, I want to hear what they have to say again in brief, and I want to study what was submitted again, and I don't really want to talk a lot more about this case because it would be inappropriate. But anyway, suffice it to say we're gonna have another bite at it, and we'll do our best.
All right. Council also reviewed the county strategic plan but didn't vote on an approval. Are we just involved with the wordsmithing here, or does the plan need some serious changes?
I think the former. You know, these strategic plans are ones that evolve, and we review them every couple of years. And so it's not a whole cloth that we're trying to make something of. And in this case, yesterday, we wanted to fine-tune some language, but it's not much more than wordsmithing.
All right. So when will the council look at possibly raising property tax rates?
Well, we wouldn't look at anything like a truth in taxation hearing until later in the year, but we may discuss various needs for funding before then, and I don't have a specific date.
So the county's strategic plan recommends that we look at the property tax rate every 5 to 8 years. Is that something that hasn't been done, or?
All right. We have three main funds, the general fund and the municipal fund and the assessing and collecting fund, and each of those has a levy. And the general fund levy has not been altered in recorded history. Now, I say that I don't mean back to pioneer era. As far back as anybody has been able to research, it hasn't been touched. The municipal fund was touched a few years ago, as you'll recall. And so what's happened for a long time, this county was able to deal with costs of inflation and you know, the increasing cost of doing business through growth in the tax base and new growth. If everything is static and there is no growth, and then assessed values go up, well, then the levy, the certified rate goes down. That makes the property tax a very stable source of revenue to local governments, but it's not, you know, people think, oh, well, property values have gone up, the county's going to bring in a lot more money. Well, that's not true because the rate goes down. And what we're going to be studying is whether or not it's time that we actually either fix the rate for 1 year so that it doesn't float downward if values go up, or whether we actually raise the rate. And to do either of those would require truth in taxation. And that would, and again, we're talking about the 2018 budget, so that would come later in the year.
All right. County Councilmember Glenn Wright yesterday said he'd like the county to be more aggressive in its carbon footprint goals. We've heard that you'd like to reduce vehicle miles traveled per capita by 5% in 10 years. Any other specific goals?
Well, we want to reduce our carbon emissions by 15% below our 2015 level by, I think it's 2030 or something, which is sounds like a modest goal, except that, you know, to reduce them, outright reduce them below a date in the past, when what we see is it's climbing all the time, it's more bold. But vehicle miles traveled are just a part of the footprint, of course. We're promoting transit and getting people alternative modes of getting around, e-bikes, you know, more bicycle pathways and rights of way, better transit, park and ride lots, just getting people out of vehicles. And of course, we've been a party to the Georgetown Award and, you know, all the renewable energy initiatives, you know, of rooftop solar and, you know, Summit Community Solar and all of those kinds of things. And we'll continue to do that.
Okay. And finally, the council approved a resolution establishing a bond up to $850,000 for the sewer district in Lower Silver Creek. But without a few more owners signing on, the county eventually will have to make a balloon payment that could be some $182,000. How many more owners do you need to sign on so that we all don't have to pay for that?
I think it's a handful. It's not very many. And so what that is, Leslie, is it's a 20-year interest-free loan from the state of Utah, and they wanted it couched in the form of a bond. And so that we created a voluntary assessment area, and we had initially, I think, 20 sign up, and out of a universe of maybe 30 or 40, I don't remember. And then we had one fall away, and that's where Kim Carson mentioned that she thought the number had been like 150, and then it drifted down to 130, and now it, in the document it's 182. And it won't take very many, and that'll be on the tail end of if we don't get any more at the end of 20 years, we'll owe $182,000 back to repay the state.
All right, Chris, I wanted to ask you also about what's happening with Bonanza Flat and the county's contribution. June 15th, of course, just around the corner.
Yeah, we are hopeful that we're going to be able to have a discussion about that and authorize those expenditures next week. That's our hope.
Okay.
We are wanting to make sure that everything is agreed to by both city and the county, but we're very close.
And Park City recently enacted a ban on single-use plastic bags for large stores. Has the county talked about following suit at all?
Well, you know, we've talked about it over the years. We haven't talked about it in the wake of what Park City did, but I personally like what they did, and I think we ought to have that discussion.
All right, Chris.
I think that we've been encouraged by some of our friends like Inza Riepen and others for many years that that was a good thing to do, and I applaud the city for its leadership in so doing.
Chris, thanks for your time this morning. 826, good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. The Snyderville Basin Planning Commission met on Tuesday night. In the studio with a recap, Planning Commissioner Chuck Klingenstein. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Leslie.
So another public hearing with regard to the Canyons Spa Amendment. A major topic is how the buildings there in the resort core, parcels 17 and 18, will affect the neighbors. Speaker Jim Preston showed you data that the neighboring buildings will be impacted by an estimated $55 million if additional heights are allowed. He basically alleging that the drops would be due to property value loss due to the loss of views, light, and ambiance. That had to catch your attention.
Well, it is certainly an interesting number, though planning commissions in the state of Utah aren't a part of discussions nor influenced by changes in property values, because we look at it from the pure planning and zoning level. And if we did start getting into economics, our friends in the legislature would remind us that's not a part of our purview. So every project out there, we look at it from a pure planning standpoint.
So what we're talking about here is measuring building height from grade as opposed to the number of stories, which I think is outlined in this SPA.
Well, what's really been difficult over the years, and this goes back 17 years since the original SPA, is grade is not what people would expect. It's not the existing grade. It's not natural grade. It's finished grade. So finished grade means bring in a bunch of soil, rocks, compact it, and you can change the grade of a parcel just by using good engineering practices. It's done all over the world. And that has made it very difficult to have a fixed point that we're, you know, building from. You know, it's pretty arbitrary, to put it quite frankly. So you've got that variable. It's not a fixed number. And then the other variable that was never very well explained in all the documentation is what's a story. Now, I think the staff report did a pretty good job of saying it alluded to 10 foot per floor. But what's been interesting, and I tried to do this the other night with the commission, we went through every building, the Grand Summit, the West Gate, and the Sundial, which are all built. And it was fascinating. There isn't a 10-foot floor in any of those buildings. The main floors are typically 14 to 20 feet. The subsequent floors are 11, sometimes 12. We took a look at some condo projects like Vintage that had a 14-foot first floor and I think it was a 12-foot second floor. And what we found is over the years, the guidelines have been used as guidelines. And the CVMA, RVMA, whatever we're calling it, Design Review Committee, they really take the first shot at these. And they found that this is what's been working well for all the buildings built so far. So I think what happened is, you know, some people saw the rewrite of the SPA amendment process, got very concerned about the height issue, and have been giving us plenty of input starting back in October of 2016. So we've been studying this very hard for a long time.
Okay, why not just do it from natural grade? Because then that everybody can see what that is, and it's like, okay, so I know if I live in this building, that's going to go up that high next to me. I mean, you can figure that out.
Yeah, and that's a good way to take a look at it. But what the problem with natural grade is we don't have a flat site. We are building on a mountainside, and so you get into slope issues. And then you got to figure out what does that mean in terms of a slope. Are you measuring from the high end of the slope, so to speak, the low end of the slope? And so the proposal that has gotten the most interest is coming up with a fixed point called elevation above sea level. That you cannot break that line. And that actually has gotten our interest because it's a fixed number. What they did is the applicants have taken a lot of time with a professional surveyor, surveyed all the existing built environment, has taken, elevations off the current topography. And we have arrived at a point where we think we've come up with a good methodology that honors what's been done in the past and doesn't provide surprises into the future.
But it is a surprise for those who have already bought a unit.
Well, that's kind of the irony of this is when they realized what was happening, they wanted to basically go to a story is 10 feet. And yet when you take a look at what's been built, what they have bought, that methodology has allowed them to have what they have. And what they're saying is they would like us to go back to maybe what they hoped the original design guidelines say. And what's interesting is they're not design standards. They are design guidelines. And the SPA echoes that throughout the development agreement. And it would have been one thing if we had started off with design standards. Everybody will adhere to these because in a way, I wish they had back in 17 years ago. And then everybody would have said, we've got to fix this and make it so it works for all the parcels being built.
Okay, so still to be decided.
And it's important. The Planning Commission just makes a recommendation to the council, and then the council will take a look at it. And it's always a fresh lens when they take a look at it, and sometimes they agree and sometimes they disagree.
What's your reaction to the Lower Village housing for some 900 employees? Certainly nice if they can get off 224, but that certainly would impact neighbors in terms of traffic. And
oh, absolutely. And the council is actually working to raise that number. I'm not sure what the final number is, and you know it's changing the configuration of the Lower Village. So as we spoke about the other night, we all agreed that we've got to work together with the council, understand their goals and objectives. We're hoping to have a joint meeting with them on this very topic, so we can understand where they're going, so we can incorporate it into the Lower Village plan that seems to be morphing before our eyes.
Real quick, the village at Silver Summit in the industrial park just north of Burt Brothers. What was your first blush reaction to the project? We're talking about 50 units of residential, office, maybe a bank, a coffee shop, and a restaurant.
Our initial thoughts were intrigued by the concept. It is definitely mixed use. It's live, work, play, recreate, eat, drink, you know, have a good time. And it's a concept that hasn't been done over there. And I think the applicant really brought up some good points with the proposal. As we, some of us would say, the devil's always in the details. They've got to go to work on certain wetlands encroachments, highway frontage encroachments, linkages to public spaces, you know, through pedestrian linkages, because it is a small little parcel in the middle of a lot of light, industrial type uses in some ways. And we just want to make sure that there's compatibility so the people living there have a good site to live in and also good access to future parks and trail systems.
So what are the setbacks from the wetlands? Did we figure that out?
That's something they're going to be working on. And Mike Franklin really nailed the numbers. He's very good on them. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but he sensed there were some encroachment issues. And it really gets back to we have to have a clear delineation of the wetlands. There was also an encroachment into the U.S. 40 right-of-way. No, not right-of-way. We have a frontage protection zone, and they had punched into that a little bit.
And so are they truly wetlands, or are we talking detention ponds?
Well, they got both things going on over there. It's the property line area between this parcel and Burt Brothers, and there is a wetlands complex in there, but there's also a detention or a retention system in there also. There's also a sewer line. So there are uplands and there are some wetlands, and I think we need to have a clear delineation of all the above.
All right, Chuck, anything else you want to mention?
No, welcome back.
Thanks. Well, Park City 7th grader Emma Grayley has created a bicycle-powered generator. It was for her science fair project. The project will now be featured in an exhibit at the Leonardo in Salt Lake City this weekend. She joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me here
today.
Yeah,
you bet. So give us a little bit of background on your project. You came up with the idea for your science fair, and
yes.
How were you inspired?
So I started this project in fifth grade, and people are very concerned about the quality of our air and water and environment in general. So I wanted to find a way where I could create a clean energy source where we could create clean, human-powered, renewable energy. And one day I saw, and I went to Parley's Park Elementary School, and one day I saw one of my teachers biking to school, and I thought it would be really interesting to find a way where you could just create electricity by just riding your bicycle.
All right, so how does your generator work?
So basically, it's a bicycle, and it's connected to a motor via a drive belt. So when you pedal, then it spins the rod in the motor that creates an electromagnetic field that creates the electrical current that flows through the wires.
All right. So is it put into a battery? I mean, how is that actually used?
Yes, it is put into a battery, and then the energy from the battery is taken by an inverter, and you can just plug in any phone or computer to that inverter and just charge your electrical device.
So is the bicycle static? I mean, is it just sit, or can it's a, something I could it, put on any
is,
bike?
It is a stationary bicycle, but there is a way that you could disconnect the bicycle and then put in your own.
So do you have a patent on this yet?
No, not yet.
Sounds like a pretty good invention.
Thank you so much.
Wow. So this will be featured at the Leonardo. How did they contact you? I mean, how did that work?
So I've been working on this project for the past 3 years, and I've entered it in the school science fair and district science fair. And I've been lucky enough to go to the Salt Lake Valley Science and Engineering Fair, the state fair. And this past year, one of my judges was Brenda Mann, and she awarded me the director's award. Because she thought, and she connected me with the Leonardo because she thought that it would be really interesting to have there. And it's really cool because you can look inside the plexiglass box and just see the electricity generation process and see all the wires and how the electricity is being made.
Okay, so the exhibit runs this weekend, Saturday,
yes.
Sunday, and Memorial Day.
Yes.
And you'll be down then all 3 days?
Yes, and it's from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Okay, and you're going to be pedaling? Or do you have some help here?
I'm going to be pedaling, and then I think I might have a couple volunteers that might want to try it out as well.
Yeah, you burn some calories, my guess.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah. So is it the harder you push on your pedal, the more electricity you create?
It's just a matter, well, yes, it is, but also it's just a matter of just being able to keep pedaling.
Okay. And then what would you use this for? I mean, like you say, it's like you charge your cell phone
on the
way to work?
Yeah, you can charge your cell phone or computer. And I'm hoping to maybe it would be interesting to put it into an airport waiting room. So that way, like if you have a delayed flight, then instead of just sitting around, then you can create your own electricity and be able to charge your phones while still being able to exercise.
Yeah. How long would it actually take to charge a cell phone?
I've tried it out before and it hasn't taken too long. It's taken about the same time as if it would be plugged into a wall outlet.
Wow, that's impressive. Do you have
Thank
a name
you.
For it?
Just human-powered generator.
Okay. So this exhibit, is it for all science fair projects?
No, actually, I'm not quite sure of all the projects, but I know that there's going to be a bicycle shop that's going to be welding bicycles, and it's just going to be a very interesting exhibit.
All right. So how did you learn how to do all of the engineering? I mean, you're in seventh grade.
Well, I started this project in fifth grade, and my uncle was an engineer, so he would teach me all the information, but then I would still be able to engineer it and connect everything as well.
Okay. Are you thinking already of about a next invention?
I'm planning on continuing this project for the next couple of years, hopefully, and being able to implement it into public locations. The Leonardo, I believe, is just a start.
Okay. So do you have somebody working with you to help you maybe, like I say, get some kind of patent on it? Or
well, I haven't gotten a patent yet, but I feel very lucky and fortunate to live in a community like Park City where there are so many smart and adults that are very generous with their time. In my first year of this project, Tim Chesley from Chesley Electric taught me about electric information and just overall safety. He donated many Saturdays and much of his time to contribute to this project. Also, Jonathan Adams from JD Construction helped me construct the plexiglass box and taught me about, safety information. The Park City Fire District taught me about hydrogen gas buildup and how I could make this safer so I could put it into a public location. And Patrick and Liz Fannin from Switchback Sports were kind enough to donate a bicycle to my project because after 2 years of being worked on, my old bicycle was getting a little broken. So they donated a new bicycle, and it was great because there were more revolutions per time you pedal.
Wow. Very impressive, Emma.
Thank
Good luck
you so
with
much.
It. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Park City 7th grader Emma Grayler. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Proud sponsor of KPCW, DeJory Center welcomes John O'Hurley, a man with standards. Best known for his role as Jay Peterman on Seinfeld and Dancing with the Stars. O'Hurley takes the main stage on August 12th for a dinner show. Tickets and information at DeJoryCenter.com.
Still to come, we'll be talking with Melanie Moffitt with Educational Advantage. We'll be talking about the successful Summer AP and Honors Prep Program. Later on in the hour, Jim Lee with the Park City Board of Realtors Philanthropic Foundation has details on the scholarships that will be awarded to Summit and Wasatch County high school students.
Support for KPCW comes from Utah Rugs. Utah Rugs is dedicated to educating children of their weavers in India and Pakistan through Care and Fair Organization. Open Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at 2876 Highland Drive or at utahrugs.com.
Well, Marsac Avenue was closed last night from the roundabout up to Hillside Avenue due to an accident that took first responders more than 4 hours to clean up. KPCW's Melissa Allison was at the scene and has the story.
Park City Dispatch received a call from a woman at 5:23 Wednesday afternoon who reported an accident that involved a semi-trailer who lost control and turned over, crashing into a multifamily home on Marsac Avenue. Summit County Dispatch, who monitors those calls, immediately dispatched emergency responders, and Battalion Chief Patrick Harwood says only the driver was injured, but the damage was extensive.
I had a gentleman lose control of his semi-trailer carrying building supplies, struck the side of this multifamily unit here, causing structural damage to the front right corner, which mainly supports the deck area, but there is some foundation issues. Also, we had approximately 200-gallon diesel fuel leak that went into a storm drain just below several houses down, along with additional coolant and other fluids from the rig.
Harwood says the crews acted quickly and other departments were on site to minimize further contamination of the surrounding area.
I just spoke with Bill from the health department, and they're working to make sure that it's contained, and essentially they didn't seem very alarmed. We got it somewhat contained down below and identified, you know, it's not threatening the water supply to the city or anything. So, again, they'll notify appropriate cleanup companies, be it via the driver or the city's resource.
KPCW News Time 8:46. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, work done last year has helped the Park City School District achieve this year's academic success. In the studio to tell us about some of the improvements that were made, I have Melanie Moffitt. She's an ELL teacher at Park City High School. Good morning, Melanie.
Good morning, Leslie.
So just give us a little bit of background to this. You worked with the district to create some new summer school programs?
Yes. What we discovered through a process of a couple of years was that we have these amazing kids and amazing parents that want their students, first-generation college students, to have access to college, and their parents and the children wanted to, but they did not have the direction or they didn't understand the process, and they didn't understand how you would take AP honors courses in order to prepare yourself for college. So what we did was we teamed up with Utah State University, and we received a generous grant from them to start a summer program where we try to equalize the playing field for these students so that they understand what it means to take an AP class, advanced placement, what it means to take an honors class, what it means to be college ready, what are their options for college. It's truly amazing. We had 20 high school students that came from 9 a.m. to 1 o'clock for an entire month for preparation. And I have high school students, and I don't think I could have talked my kids into this, and these kids came every single day. It's a requirement to have 100% attendance.
Wow. So are these just ELL students, or are these anybody who are interested?
This is for first generation. So you don't necessarily have to be English as a second language, although that is our main focus for the program.
Okay. So, and these weren't necessarily high-achieving kids. These are just kids that really want a step ahead.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. We had some students that were really struggling, and we put them in the program. We have three levels. We had a student that had issues with attendance last year. He never missed a day of the summer program. He has now moved into Latinos in Action. He has kept a 3.0 and made a complete turnaround.
So some good success there. Let's just take a step back and talk a little bit about your background. I mean, you are the founder of Educational Advantage, so you have tutored kind of struggling kids or kids that just need, again, a little bit extra help, and now moved into the school district as an ELL teacher?
Yes, that's exactly right. I sold Educational Advantage about 5 years ago, and actually that's where this pilot program started with Educational Advantage, Back to the Roots, and the generosity of Greg Zahner. We had a very small group that we started with, and we tutored them in ACT prep. Then the program evolved into the summer program that we started last year.
All right. So was there a cost for the kids to participate?
We have a cost for the kids to participate. It is $50, which helps with some of the materials, et cetera.
All right. So the grant that you received helped pay for the people that are there every day.
Yes. The grant that we received from Utah State University was $20,000. And that's $1,000 a student to pay for the teachers. The kids get to do an overnight visit to Utah State. They had a wonderful time. One of the key factors that we discovered with the program is a lot of first-generation kids, they don't know all the possibilities of what you can be as far as a profession. They look at it, oh, I can be a teacher. I can be a counselor. I can be a policeman. They have no idea all the opportunities. And it was really great because they got to go up to Utah State and see the water lab. They saw how they all were interested in environmental science. They got to see aerospace. It's really neat that they get to see all the different jobs they could have.
Yeah. So those 4 hours each morning that they do, I mean, how is that time spent?
Well, it's pretty intense. We have phenomenal, phenomenal teachers that stepped up. Lauren Parrish is amazing. She's young and has energy. And she prepped the kids in academic language and math skills for chemistry, anatomy, and AP environmental science. Michaela Damas is a ball of energy. And she helps the kids. The nice thing is that the kids can work really hard and they can earn a government credit. And we go through academic language in social studies with government. That's very difficult for English as a second language students. And she goes through closed reading strategies with them. And we're in very small groups, which makes it really nice. And we are adding Kevin Fober to the program. And he will be doing AP U.S. History, which what the seniors told us who did it last year, they said, we wish we would have had this as juniors. And the Parksea School District and Bob O'Connor have really stepped up to say, okay, we will support the juniors in this program.
Great. So how do you think this is going to help the achievement gap? Because that's certainly one of the big goals of the school board.
Well, we already saw an increase in the ACT scores. Just to give you an example, the year before we started the program, as far as non-LIA, Latino in Action students, we did not have students taking advanced classes. Their parents didn't know about it. The students didn't really know the advantage of it. We went from zero kids taking college prep math to 18. We went from one student taking a medical CTE course, EMS, CNA, to 7. We went from zero taking concurrent enrollment English to 10, and we went from zero taking AP science courses to 12. And I want to reiterate that we had Latino in Action students take these courses, but students that weren't involved in Latino in Action.
Right. So what's going to happen this summer then?
So this summer, it's amazing. We got the extra funding for the juniors, and we will be covering AP U.S. History. We'll be covering AP Environmental Science. We have two students taking AP Chemistry next year. We have two students taking AP Biology. We will be going over concurrent enrollment English and AP Language.
So people who may be interested just need to contact the front office there to enroll?
We actually had an application process. So we are full, but if you have a sophomore and they are first generation, we would love to have them on our list join the program.
All right. Anything else you want to mention?
No, I'd just like to thank everybody for all their support. And I need to have a shout out to Kelly Yates because I forgot. She is an amazing English teacher, and she will be helping as well.
Okay. Hey, Melanie, thanks for coming in. 8:55, good morning. Well, the Park City Board of Realtors has come up with a bunch of money for local student scholarships. In the studio with details, I have members of the board's philanthropic foundation, Ramon Gomez and Jim Lee. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Jim, you want to start or Roman, about the philanthropic foundation?
Jim can start. He's the leader.
Yeah. Well, the philanthropic foundation has been in place since about 1999. And with our main focus of supporting the schools and scholarships. And every year we give scholarships. And we used to just do it in Park City. Now we do it to Park City High, Wasatch High, North Summit, and South Summit. So we've spread our wings a bit, and we cover a lot more terrain real estate-wise. So hence, that's what we do.
Yeah, so the money comes from where?
The realtors. And we're really proud because just a few years ago, we were under $10,000, and this year we did scholarships of $22,500. So we're really happy how the realtors have stepped up and wanted to contribute to this fine organization.
Okay,
and
so
help
it,
these kids.
Is it just part of a sale, or is it just they just make contributions?
No, they make donations.
Yeah, is all of the money then used for scholarships, or is it used for other endeavors?
Some other things, but the scholarship is the main focus by far. That's why it was created in theory. But we go a little farther beyond those bounds. But it's just really great. The whole purpose and the function of the philanthropic foundation is to give back to the community. It's to improve the community that we are a part of and that we bring new people from out of town, too.
All right. So three at Park City High School and then two students at each of the other high schools.
Yes.
How did you determine who gets the money?
You know, it's actually a heartbreaking process because basically our outline is we try to give scholarships to children, kids that have great grades but have been overlooked by other scholarships. So the school counselors will give us a group of resumes, if you would, and it's some heartbreaking stories out there, and we just try to help those kids that were overlooked that really could use it and tell their story.
So it's not necessarily academic.
No, it isn't. And as Ramon indicates here, it's someone who needs the financial assistance there. But we also look for one other aspect of somebody that's perhaps dealt with and overcome maybe a challenge or two or three. And that's what pulls the heartstrings. And that's what is the feel-good process takes place when, you know, you're helping someone out that's really been through a lot, and you kind of look at yourself and go, whoa, I got it pretty easy compared to what some of these kids have gone through.
Yeah. So can you tell us who they are, or is it still a surprise?
Surprise.
Surprise.
Because it's handed out, I think, during the scholarship.
Yeah, it's actually
2 weeks.
In the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And at Park City, at least.
Mm-hmm. And, it's $2,500 a piece.
Yes, for 9 different scholarships. So $22,500, and we're pretty proud to be able to do that.
Yeah. So all these kids obviously going to college. Any idea where? Here locally, maybe? Or
You know, all over. We find them going everywhere, whether it's even maybe a junior college. And then some are going back to the Ivy Leagues, you know. That's what the impressive thing is to look over these kids' resumes, and you kind of question yourself when you were that age thinking, oh my God, did I know what I was headed for? And their resumes are most impressive.
Yeah. So what kind of participation do you get from the realtors?
Meaning
how many? There's like 1,000 of you, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Actually, I don't know how many people because we're always looking at the dollar amount.
Right. So. There's technically about 1,100 agents, and it's everyone donates a little. Let's put it that way. We don't have a major contributor, but it's everyone pitches in and for that feel-good process.
All right. Well, and early congratulations to those nine students. Yeah, nice gift. All right, guys.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Leslie.